Hi and welcome back. This is the first of a two-part episode on trace fossils we recorded with Professor Tony Martin of Emory University. We originally recorded this interview as one single episode, but ended up with so much material that we thought it would be a bit much, so we're releasing the second part in 2 weeks' time. It's also for this reason that we're keeping this introduction pretty short. This was the first audio we recorded using our brand new recorders, and whilst they improved the audio quality, we had issues with the sensitivity that we only realised after recording. So we've reviewed our recording process, so hopefully this was got us covered for future releases. And so although there is a bit of noise on this episode, we agreed with Tony that it doesn't detract from what we all consider to be a great discussion about trace fossils. So I hope you enjoy it.
Hello, and welcome to Paleocast. I'm John Tennant, and with me today is Dave Marshall and Tony Martin.
Hello, how's it going there?
All right, thanks, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing great. All caffeinated and ready to go.
Well, hey, excellent. Cool. This is the second time we've had to get Tony on. We had a bit of a malfunction last time. Dave was being a bit of a technophobe, so, but luckily...
Hey, it was all good from my end. Don't blame it on me.
Yeah, well, let's blame it on the Yank, shall we?
Okay, so Tony, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please, and your background?
Yeah, I'm a ichnologist, paleontologist, and geologist. And I guess everybody who's going to listen to this knows what a paleontologist and geologist is. So the question is going to be, what the heck is an ichnologist? And an ichnologist is someone who studies traces. So it comes from the Greek ichnos, the study of traces. Traces would be tracks, trails, burrows, feces, nests, tooth marks, any sort of indirect evidence left by life. And that could be either modern traces or fossil traces. So that's where the paleo aspect of it comes in, is that I oftentimes look at modern traces, compare those to what's preserved in the fossil record, and make direct comparisons between those.
So if you're saying you're studying indirect evidence for fossils, why would you do that instead of direct evidence?
Trace fossils are so much more alive than all of those body fossils. I mean, I just look at those body fossils and I was like, okay, so you got a dead body. So what? Trace fossils hold a lot more mystery to me. They're like clues left at the scene of a crime, but the crime was committed millions of years ago, and there's no body left behind either. They also go way, way beyond answering just who done it. And that's usually the question I get about trace fossils is, well, what made it? Or, well, we can't really know what made it, can we? To which I say, well, yes, we sometimes can answer who did it, and that's the least interesting question oftentimes to us. We want to know what that animal was doing. Why was it doing it? Was it interacting with another animal? How was it reacting to whatever was happening in its environment in real time at the time that trace was made? Those are all questions that go through our minds when we look at this indirect evidence. So I like to think that this indirect evidence is actually oftentimes more powerful in reconstructing, especially animal behavior, but also past ecosystems through looking at these traces.
I agree.
I was ready for an argument.
Well, I bigged up trace fossils in that post the other day for Discover Mag. I was like, yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah, so, that's right. They are awesome.
Pretty good. Okay. Can you tell us about some of the different types of trace fossil that we can find and what they can tell us individually?
Sure. Yeah, I was just thinking going through what I've been working on in the last 5 years or so, and it's a fairly long list and varied list. I've looked at, for instance, root traces, starting with plants, that plants, as they move their roots through sediments or sometimes even rock, they can modify the sediments and leave traces of that plant behavior. So those are some traces that I've been, and trace fossils I've been studying in recent years. Insect traces. I did a study, the paper came out a couple of years ago, co-authored with Dave Verrecchio, who's a vertebrate paleontologist. We looked at insect traces, pupae and burrows that were associated with dinosaur nesting horizons in Montana. They were near the Troodon nests. And what those insect traces told us is that these nesting grounds were probably very much of a kind of well-drained soils and kind of a semi-arid environment, not too much vegetation, and so on, which is exactly where a lot of modern insects like to nest today. And we interpreted these as wasps. So that's an example of where you can put together insect traces with dinosaur trace fossils, for instance. Other types of traces can be vertebrate burrows. I've been studying alligator burrows recently, gopher tortoise burrows, but also any other types of vertebrate burrows. How do those preserve in the geologic record? What behaviors do those reflect? Other invertebrate burrows could be marine invertebrates or marine invertebrate tracts. I've also studied those, modern and ancient. Trilobite burrows, for instance, I find fascinating that trilobites didn't just stay on the surface, but they actually burrowed. Oh, I could go on and on. I better stop.
So what are the, I mean, you mentioned trilobites. They've been around for about 530 million years. So what are the oldest trace fossils we can actually come across, or which you found personally, I guess?
Oh, the oldest trace fossils I've found specifically? That's a tough one to answer. I have seen some Ediacaran trace fossils from North Carolina, right here in the United States. We have some Ediacaran rocks. They're around 548, 550 million years old. So in the Ediacaran, not quite into the Cambrian. And these are just simple trails, surface trails, or they were just underneath the biomass being made by a metazoan. They were not made by lichens. But I also had the privilege of, I saw where you did a podcast recently, a paleocast, I'm sorry. sorry, got to get the brand in there. About Mistaken Point. And I had the privilege this past August of seeing some of the trace fossils that were there. Those were spectacular. They were just fantastic to see. Knowing that these were metazoan trails from 565 million years ago, that was just absolutely wonderful.
You know, the fossils at Mistaken Point, they're preserved as molds, right?
Yeah, the body fossils are, but who cares about those? We're talking about trace fossils.
Right? Hey, I mean, I was just wondering, how difficult is it to get them kind of confused, you know, if they're both just kind of imprints in the sediment or the rock?
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Yeah, and that's something I often try to talk about with my students. I say, if you find, say, an impression of a leaf on the sidewalk, is that a trace of that leaf? And I go, well, no, but we could look at that leaf impression, and are there little holes or bite marks taken out of that leaf? Ooh, there are some traces there. Now we're talking. Now I'm interested. Whereas a lot of body fossils that are preserved as impressions or molds, for instance, those are body fossils. That's from a dead animal. Unless you have the fortuitous aspect of what was recently called a mort ichneon or a taff ichneon, where you actually have the dead animal at the end of its trace, like with horseshoe crabs from the Jurassic and a few other examples.
Mort ichneon translate to, sorry?
Yeah, mort ichneon translates to a death trace. Taff ichneon would translate to more like burial trace, that this animal was in the act of being buried when it was making the trace, but also implies that that's a dying trace as well.
That's pleasant.
Yeah. Tapichnian. And then the distinction between trace fossils and body fossils, it's a very good question to ask with regard to, if you're looking at just an impression of a body, for instance, you ask yourself, was that dead when that impression was made? And if the answer is yes, then it's a body fossil. If it was still alive when it was making that impression, then we might call that a resting trace, for instance. I love resting traces, absolutely wonderful trace fossils, because they usually provide a lot of the anatomy of the animal while it stops there and leaves an impression of its body in the sediment. But if there are tracks walking away from it, then I go ahead and conclude reasonably that, oh, it was still alive afterwards.
Do you think that there might be a lot of cases where you get molds of fossils, but they're actually trace fossils, resting traces, rather than body fossils?
Yeah, in many instances, that may be true. I'm thinking in particular about trilobites, of course, leaving beautiful resting traces. And then you see this beautiful resting trace, and there may not be necessarily a burrow preserved leading away from it, or there may not be tracks preserved leading away from it. Also bivalves. I've seen many bivalve traces, beautiful resting traces from bivalves, where it just has that gorgeous almond type of outline of the clam. You look at that and say, wow, okay, well, did it die there and then the shell dissolved away? Well, we sometimes don't know, because the burrow leading away from it may not have gotten preserved. So those are instances of where I ask myself, is it a body fossil? Is it a trace fossil? Sometimes it's a combination of the two. And that's always a good point to argue over a pint or two.
Is there any point in differentiating the two?
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Oh, yeah. In fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because an article that I co-authored several years ago about these Ediacaran, we didn't focus on the Ediacaran trace fossils. In the title of it, with the North Carolina Ediacaran fossils, my co-authors and I, we asked the rhetorical question, body fossils or trace fossils? And it was with reference to a fossil called Oldhamia recta. We questioned whether it was a trace fossil, whereas other people had interpreted it as a trace fossil. We questioned that, we examined it carefully, and we came to the conclusion that no, this is a body fossil. And that's an example of where we really do have to pay attention to such an important distinction. You don't call a dinosaur track a brachiopod.
Oh, yeah.
And when people say, oh, does it matter? Well, yes, it does matter. It's not about naming, it's about being correct, I think, in assigning the way we classify, the way we categorize. Yeah, so does that make sense?
Perfect, yes.
Great.
I like trace fossils, they're cool.
Yes, yes. We're getting along better and better.
So, you know, with respect to like these ones like the Mortichnia or Death March or whatever it was called, can the trace fossils themselves tell us something about the kind of environment in which the fossil lived and or died? Can we speculate about that kind of thing from trace fossils? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because one of the great things about particularly trace fossils made by animals is that there are very few animals that are adapted for low oxygen conditions, for instance, like completely anoxic environments. Basically, what animals would have to do in such a situation is carry the oxygen with them somehow, or pump oxygen into, say, a burrow in an anoxic sort of environment. One example that comes to mind is a study I did with several colleagues on a fish trace fossil. So there's where we get confusing, because it's kind of ichnological ichthyology or ichthyological ichnology. I'm not sure which. But this was a fish trace fossil from the Eocene. From about 50 million years ago, this fish, Notogonius osculus, yes, I can tell you exactly what fish did it, and I can tell you how big it was. We'll get to that in a minute. This fish swam along the bottom of the lake, and this was the Green River Formation, the classic fossil lake of the Green River Formation at Fossil Butte National Monument. Paleontologically rich, long history, fantastic sort of lake environment from the Eocene. This fish was swimming in what was supposed to be the deepest part of the lake, in which you get these exquisite body fossils of fish preserved. So the assumption for more than 100 years has been, this is a low oxygen environment. Nothing could live here. Well, this fish trace fossil said otherwise. It said, well, no, here was a rather large fish. It was about 45 centimeters long. was swimming along the bottom, and it was feeding along the bottom. It had a downwardly pointing mouth. So it left these little sucker marks from its mouth in the middle of the trail from where its tail fin and its pelvic fin and its anal fin all left the trail. Beautiful sinusoidal wave trail. And the mouth marks in the middle of that. Just a fantastic trace fossil. And right then and there showed there was oxygen at the bottom of the lake when that fish was swimming there. So then it calls into question the whole premise that, oh, this lake was completely anaerobic, nothing could live there.
Well, so just one trace fossil has completely transformed the way we interpret an entire Lagerstätten. That's
incredible. Well, what we did then, and here's the great thing, is that now more trace fossils of fish have been found from that same zone within the Green River Formation at the same locality. And now the people who quarry the fish outside of the park, for instance, they're now alerted to this, and they're finding these trace fossils more frequently. Now they know to look for them. Now they know what to look for them. So one of the reasons why I loved doing that study was that it got the word out. We also published it in PLOS One in 2010. So it made it publicly available. We also did a digital really detailed zoom in, zoom out kind of digital map of the trace fossil so that anybody with access to the internet with the right software can take a look at that trace fossil too, and they will then have a mental picture of what to look for. So I'm totally confident that we're not only going to get hundreds of trace fossils like this out of the same deposit, but we'll start finding them in other places where there are assumed to be anaerobic conditions. All you have to do is look for them, you'll find them.
So because you made the article open access, you effectively initiated like an entirely new kind of trade around the Green River Formation. Is that right?
Oh, it's very interesting.
You boosted the local economy.
Yeah, well, what's very interesting is there's been great cooperation that's come out of this in that these professional fossil collectors, they don't want to sell the trace fossils, but they're very happily donating the trace fossils to Fossil Butte National Monument. So the paleontologist who works there, he has alerted them to this. They very happily call him up and say, hey, we found another fish trail. Can we donate it? So they donate it to Fossil Butte National Monument. So then it becomes federal property. That's right. It gets a specimen name, and now it can be studied. So I was out there just this past summer studying some more of the specimens, and those are some future papers that will be coming up. That is a result of that sort of cooperation between professional fossil collectors, the federal government here in the U.S., and then me at an academic institution. It's a great example of how this can work. And I think publishing a paper in PLOS One really got that going.
Excellent. I'm going to steal that case study at some point.
Yeah, I think so. They also did a display at Fossil Butte National Monument where they reconstructed the fish because we identified the species of fish. There was only one fish that could have had a downwardly pointing mouth that could have made that. Then one of my colleagues, based on the waveforms left by the fins, figured out what was the size of the fish based on the proportions, based on the sine wave function. He used a Fourier transform analysis. And we actually said, not only was it this fish, but it was this long. And I wish you could see me holding my hands out in front of me. But it was 45 plus or minus, I think, 1.7 centimeters long, something like that.
It sounds like a pretty unique case, this, in that you have a Lagerstätten where you have the body fossils of the fish that you're able to say these produced the trace fossils and make the direct comparison. So again, it brings into question whether the body fossil or the trace fossil is the most important bit. But in circumstances where you don't have the associated body fossils, how are you able to assign a producer to any given trace fossil that you might have?
It's a great question. It's something a colleague of mine at the University of West Alabama, Andy Rensburg, he and I oftentimes we use the term bioprint, and it's kind of adapted from Dolph Seilocker talking about the fingerprint, for instance, that an animal, a trace maker, will leave in the fossil record. So oftentimes we look for those sorts of bioprints, that bioprint being, here's some clue from the anatomy of the tracemaker that helps us to narrow down who it was. So where we don't have body fossils, a great example of that are some Ordovician and Silurian trilobite trace fossils we looked at. Some of these trace fossils from the Ordovician of Georgia, for instance, they were these beautiful round circular cross-section backfilled burrows, and they sometimes went into trackways. Well, at the end of one of these trackways was the beautiful outline of what looked like a little cryptolithid type of trilobite. So right away, we were able to say from that sort of bioprint, aha, okay, we don't have a body fossil of a trilobite like that anywhere in the deposit, but right there we were able to say this was probably a cryptolithid type of trilobite. Also, we could count the leg impressions. Also, we could look at the width of the burrow. The width of the burrow limits the width of the animal. Oftentimes, there's a positive correlation between body mass, for instance, and the burrow cross-sectional area. Nice mathematical sorts of expressions of that. Using all those clues together, we can at least narrow it down, and we can say what it's not and get closer to saying what it is in the absence of body fossils.
Are there any examples of trace fossils that we have absolutely no clue what produced them?
Yeah, well, absolutely no clue. Ooh, yeah. I don't want to speak for my colleagues on that. Because my ethnological colleagues, they do have some pretty good ideas about some of the trace makers for some of these traces. I think the big frontier right now, and it's a great example of what I call, lots of people call, reverse uniformitarianism, is the deep sea. And what happened with deep sea traces and deep sea ichnology is that the trace fossils were found first. So the classic flish sort of deposits in Europe, for instance, that had these trace fossils that the European paleontologists looked at them, and based on the sedimentology, they said these had to have been made in deep water. But the assumption at the time was that, well, nothing lives in the deep sea today. Well, of course, when we sent submersibles down, we realized, well, the deep sea is actually teeming with life. There's all sorts of life that's interacting with the substrate and leaving all sorts of traces, trails, burrows, all sorts of structures down there. So some of these deep sea traces, one trace fossil that comes to mind is Zophicus. A lot of my colleagues think, well, that's being made by some kind of worm. Well, as we know, worm. Well, yeah, that helps a lot. How many tens of thousands of species of worms and which phylum, et cetera? Which clade are you talking about? Okay, Cypunculus, polychaetes, Nemercarian. What are you talking about? So just to say worm, this is one of my pet peeves. Somebody says, is that a worm burrow? Kind of throw that back in their face. I rattle off all the different types of blades of worms. But this is the problem, I think, with the deep sea. It's so difficult to directly observe a trace maker making a trace that it's still a bit of a mystery who's making some of those traces as a modern analog for what's in the deep sea deposits that have trace fossils in which we don't have the body fossils of the trace makers. Kind of a long, circuitous route there, but that's the best I think I can give you right now. We're still a little mystified by deep sea trace fossils. They're trace makers.
In cases like that, is it possible to kind of look at modern deep sea fauna and seeing how they're interacting with the sediment to see, you know, what's causing these kind of trace fossils in deep time?
Yeah, of course, those kind of excursions, that kind of field work is a little expensive from what I understand. And it takes a lot of doing. Now, what's really cool, there's an IMAX film with Dolph Zeilacher on it. So if you want to see Dolph in IMAX format, a four-story tall screen, it's kind of daunting if you've ever met him in person. But it's a wonderful film in that he went down with a marine biologist who studies deep sea fauna. So they went down together into the submersible, went to the deep sea, and they were looking specifically for what was making say, these Paleodictyon type of deep sea traces, a beautiful kind of hexagonal type of pattern that we oftentimes see in rocks, say from the Paleozoic all the way up, I think until relatively recent, they're preserved. And they actually did find some modern analogs. They did not find the tracemaker in it. Now, they took a core sample in which they were able to get this Paleodictyon type of pattern, so kind of incipient Paleodictyon, but they did not have the tracemaker again. So that would be the way to do it, but it's so, like I said, so expensive, so infrequent, so difficult for a lot of ichnologists to be able to do that kind of work that I personally feel better about just going down to, say, the Georgia coast and observing the more shallow marine or the terrestrial traces.
Very subtle lead in there.
Yes.
Maybe we need to get James Cameron on the side of ichnologists and fund a few billion-pound expeditions to the bottom of the sea. That could be useful.
Oh, very useful, indeed.
If I remember Paleodictyon correctly from my undergrad course, isn't that a farming trace?
Yeah, that's what we would call a farming trace. The terrestrial equivalent of that would be, say, some of these leafcutter ants, some of these ants that make huge nests in which they will take leaf cuttings and they grow fungi on the leaves. So those sorts of structures could get preserved in fossil record too. Any trace, then, in which an animal is modifying its environment so that it's growing its own food, that we call a so-called farming trace, or, as to use our terminology, agrichnia. But I do try not to say that, those sorts of terms, too often, because I see people's eyes get glazed over and they look across the room and they say, excuse me, goodbye. So I really do try to use those sorts of specialized terms less and less nowadays.
And whilst we're on the subject of ants, do termite mounds ever get preserved? Because they're a pretty big structure modification of the sediment that we can see today. Are there any examples of those in the past?
Yeah, boy, that's a controversial subject. I'm a little hesitant to give an opinion on it. I have seen, because the people who study that, it's quite contentious, because this is a great example of where I think the trace fossil record is preceding the body fossil record, that social insects, these sort of eusocial insect traces, I do think show up before a good body fossil record for, say, ants, which are hymenopterans, and then termites, isopterans, before we get a really good body fossil record for those. Because body fossil record for those we get from Cretaceous amber, for instance. There's no doubt, these are ants, these are termites. But then as soon as you get this big nest-like structure that looks like a termite nest or looks like an ant nest from the late Jurassic, wait, we don't have any body fossils. Therefore, it is not a termite mound. Therefore, it is not. Well, I feel like that sometimes being unnecessarily conservative. What we do have to do, and this is the responsibility of ichnologists, is we have to document extremely carefully, meticulously describe and compare these weird, big, complex structures we find, say, from the Jurassic. A few people have even claimed them from the Triassic. I'm a little skeptical of those. But from the late Jurassic, I don't see any reason why not. There could not be insects doing behavior. I won't say they're ants. I won't say they're termites. But making nest structures, behaving in a eusocial manner like termites, for instance. And I think that's all the opinion I'll give on that. Like I said, it is contentious. There's quite a bit of arguing back and forth about that going on right now between very good ichnologists.
So arguing is unheard of, I thought, with geologists.
Yeah, it is unheard of. So, Kamok, what else?
Yeah, okay, so you mentioned the Georgia coast, and I guess this would be a good time for you to plug your latest book.
Oh, my book. Oh, I'm so glad you brought up my book. Yes, thank you.
So could you tell us a little bit about some of the kind of trace fossils which you found in the Georgia coast and, you know, how it relates to paleoecology and modern environments and, you know, the whole shebang?
Yeah, the book is titled Life Traces of the Georgia Coast, Revealing the Unseen Lives of Plants and Animals. What it does is it looks at modern traces. About 9/10 of the book is about modern traces and their ecosystems and substrates of the Georgia Bear Islands, using these as examples that you could compare to what we have in the fossil record. I actually only have one chapter in the book that's about trace fossils and how do these traces, these modern traces, or what we would call neoecology, how do these modern traces compare to what we find in the geologic record as a whole? So it's taking the traces from one specific place. Let's narrowly focus on this place, however incredible it is, compared to what we have in the fossil record. And they actually match fairly well. So that's one of the points I try to make in the book, is that you can go to the Georgia Bear Islands and a few other special places in the world, and you can do these direct comparisons. But it does take lots of field time, lots of dirt time, getting out there and looking at a wide variety of traces. I looked at plant traces, terrestrial invertebrate traces, terrestrial vertebrate traces, marginal marine vertebrate traces, marginal marine invertebrate traces, everything. I was completely unbiased in my ichnological endeavors in this respect. So I had to wear quite a few hats in doing the book. So there's no surprise that it came out close to 700 pages. And bless my editors for keeping so much in it, because it is, I think, the first comprehensive neoecology book done, as far as I know, certainly of the Georgia coast, but of most places in the world.
Available on Amazon.
Oh, yeah. That would be a rough one to do. But here's the cool thing. The Georgia Barrier Islands, because they're barrier islands, so they have this extremely wide range of ecosystems and substrates in a small place. Mm. You can go from one ecosystem to the next very rapidly in about, just say, a straight line 10-minute walk. You can go from completely terrestrial to subtidal conditions. So in that respect, I like it as a very neat sort of place to do these comparisons very quickly, efficiently, effectively. And when I take students down to the Georgia coast, it's a great way to teach them instantly. Here are some of the lateral relationships and differences you'll see in modern traces. Hey, I wonder if we could apply that to the geologic record.
Are there examples in the geological record of trace fossils being made on different kind of substrates? So one being made in sand and one being made in mud, and you're able to compare the two?
Right, yeah. The examples a lot of people reach for in that respect, kind of classic examples in ichnology, are, say, if you get a crustacean burrow, for instance. Let's take our typical digging decapod, a 10-legged crustacean. It's got some good digging appendages in the front, and it's born to burrow. So it burrows, and sometimes as it's burrowing, say, through a soft sand, it encounters this stiff mud. Well, do you think that digging decapod cares? No. It's basically kind of like the honey badger in this respect. It just starts burrowing. I'm not going to say it on tape, don't worry. But then it starts burrowing into that stiff mud. It doesn't care. But then it might even encounter rock. And in some instances, I know of a few instances where a crustacean is digging along happily in unconsolidated sediment, then it encounters rocks. Then it'll actually bore a little bit into what was originally rock. That's pretty impressive. So sometimes these crustaceans, in their behavior, as they're going through different substrates, they're modifying their behavior according to the substrate. So it's the same trace maker. If you just follow it along, it's going into different substrates and just adjusting accordingly.
Cool.
Do you ever get a situation where you'd have a burrow entirely in sand and a burrow entirely in mud, and you're able to say that these two are the same, produced by the same animal?
Ooh, good question. Yeah, that would be a tough one. The modern example I'm thinking of, there's actually with on the Georgia coast, there are fiddler crabs, for instance. And there's a little bit of habitat partitioning in two species of fiddler crabs, where one of them is a sand fiddler crab. So, duh, you guessed it, it burrows in sand exclusively. Then there's the mud fiddler crab. What do you think it burrows in? So they clearly had a common ancestor not too long ago, and the genetics backs this up. But at some point not too long ago in their evolutionary history, they split ways, and one of them is specially adapted to burrowing in mud, one of them is specially adapted to burrowing in sand. Their burrows do look completely different. And I think that's a function of substrate, but that's also a function of behavior. As we're starting to learn now, the connections between genes and behavior, that great study that came out about a month ago about old field burrowing mice, for instance, that beautiful connection between you change a gene in a mouse and it's going to burrow differently. I think we're going to start seeing that also demonstrated with invertebrates. These fiddler crabs, I could look at their burrows in the fossil record, something analogous, and say, oh, that's from something that's more like a mud fiddler, even if it's preserved in, say, sandstone. Or I could see a burrow that's preserved in a mudstone and say, ooh, that looks a lot more like a sand fiddler burrow. So that sort of confusion can sometimes happen too, based on what we're seeing today, thinking about substrate-related trace makers. And you ask yourself, is this the behavior that's modifying, or it's modified by the organism simply because it's still in its evolutionary hardwiring, or is it because it's reacting to the substrate? Wow, that's a two-beer question, actually.
Yeah.
That would require two beers before I could really get into it.
That's science, folks.
That's science in a nutshell. And especially paleontology. That's how it's been for the last 200 years.
So other than putting Adolf Sylacca into a submarine, are there any other new technologies that are helping ichnologists better understand trace fossils?
Yeah, other than Adolf Sylacca going down to the bottom of the sea in a submersible. Yeah, we're using all sorts of cool new technologies nowadays. In my work, I've been working with a geographer who specializes in GIS, Michael Page. He's here at Emory with me. We've started mapping some of the alligator dens that are on one of the Georgia Barrier Islands. So there we're combining GIS with LIDAR, and that's laser scanning from a plane, for instance, and laser scanning of a landscape, taking the LIDAR database, combining that with the GIS, where we ground truth. Here are where the alligator dens are located, telling us where they're, and the old dens are located, telling us where those alligators used to den. That's kind of cool, because then we can relate that to how did archosaurs burrow in the geologic past. Where could we predict their burrows to occur in different sort of rocks that we look at from the geologic past? We're also using ground penetrating radar. So a couple of colleagues I have at another Georgia university, we've been using ground penetrating radar to try to image some of these burrows, like the alligator dens, as well as gopher tortoise burrows. These provide us with great models for how these burrows would look in the geologic record or similar sorts of burrows. Peter Falkingham, for instance, is also working with photogrammetry, and a lot of other people working with photogrammetry, where they're taking these multiple digital images and pasting them together into 3D models of, say, dinosaur tracks, burrows, and other sorts of trace fossils. Now, here's the thing, though. All that's cool. All that's gee whiz. Oh, yes, technology. Oh, it's wonderful. Oh, I'm doing science now.
Is that your British accent?
Oh, yes. My people into this, I think this too. Okay, but I like to add, here's the ichno curmudgeon putting his hat on. Aren't these all fancy, expensive hand lenses? Aren't these just hand lenses where we still have to observe? We still have to very carefully observe what this technology is telling us. And it's the old GIGO kind of acronym. It used to be garbage in, garbage out. Now it's gospel in, gospel out. Still, we ask ourselves, just because this was generated by a very expensive high-tech piece of equipment and produces a beautiful 3D rotating model, does that make it better? This is always a good question for us to ask. I love how the technology is now starting to get employed in technology, but I also try to back myself up from it sometimes and say, is this making it necessarily any better? What are we observing that we weren't observing before when we simply went into the field or we went into a museum tour to look at these trace fossils? So I'm just throwing that out there just for all the people who are dazzled by technology for technology's sake. Do be self-critical about your use of it. I love using it, but still be critical about it too.
I guess a lot of people would say that if you have digital copies of this kind of thing, then other people can use it, and it can be reused and remixed.
Yeah, so that's the great thing about that. Yeah, this is one of the things I've really enjoyed about seeing with digital photography, for instance. Now we can share it so much more easily. Or digital video. Now we can upload. If I have this digital video of an echinoderm burrowing, for instance, I can upload that to YouTube and share that with millions of people who are looking for burrowing echinoderms.
As many of us do in our spare time.
Exactly. So this is one of the cool aspects, I think, of digital technology. It is allowing us to be more open. We're able to share our primary data more openly with the public, with other scientists. And that, to me, is a really exciting aspect of it.
So that's the end of this first part on trace fossils with Professor Tony Martin. Here's a little preview of what you can look forward to on the next episode of PaleoCast. We'll see you then.
It's more likely the animals died in the burrow before they got buried.
Would the dinosaurs have been able to have migrated, or were they pretty much stuck down there on the South Pole?
Totally inappropriate garb, and many of my female paleontologist colleagues have chuckled quite a bit about it.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.